So many of you may recall that it was just a few months ago now, it feels like much longer ago than that, but it was in the early fall that I had promised to finish up our centennial year, 2016, by taking one Sunday per month to preach on why we light these candles of fellowship. Not in a general way, but to take each one and ask the question of, are we still accountable to the words and to the light that we begin our service with each Sunday? This morning, I'm hoping that we can enter into a conversation about our candle on accessibility. And over the next few months, I do promise that at the end of this church year, we will have completed the five, and then I promise that in the years to come, we will keep doing this, because we will need to deepen and change the ways in which we are held accountable to each. In thinking about this particular candle on striving to be accessible to all, I realize that it has been 3 years now since I first entered this sanctuary and met for the first time so many of you who I now love with such ferocity. If you recall, if you were here, it was a whirlwind meeting. 8 days, 2 Sunday services, more meals, meet and greets, interviews, listening circles, and more than you could possibly imagine. It was a joyful week, and an exhausting one, but a joyful one, and it's almost incredible to think now about what I remember, who I remember, those small moments that made me stop and sturdy myself and hope that I would do justice to the ministry I was hoping to begin with each of you. Natalie Ron sat right there with her parents. They in their chairs and she in her wheelchair. It's one of the most vivid memories that I have from those few years ago. I knew of Natalie, of course, because Lori was on my search committee, and so I sought Natalie out after the service. And Natalie, not unlike her mother in that moment or in the weeks to follow, I learned, was crying. And I took it to be a moment, Natalie's tears, not unlike what I was feeling of awe of the energy in the room for the possibility of what was to come. But what she said, eyes locked with mine, her hands gripping my own, was, rise in body or spirit. I was waiting to know what you were going to say, and you said it, rise in body or spirit. It was a few days later and further into my candidating week with you all when I received a note from someone anonymously. It said that their hope for me, for their new minister, would be to utilize the screen. Now let me step back and tell you that with this first line, I just presumed it was a young person, someone who was used to taking information in like this, who felt like it was the modern thing to do. During the search process, when Lou asked me what I thought of the screen, so smoothly as he would, I said, I think that's a trick question. Because the screen, as many of us know, is beloved by some and despised by others. Underutilized or gratefully unused. You're showing yourselves. As I read the note, I realized very quickly, though, that this was not about being the cool young church like I thought it was, because the congregant explained that each time a hymn is sung, this person needs to make a decision. Hold on to the hymnal and sing with the rest of the congregation seated. Or hold on to the chair in front of them in order to be able to stand, to feel safely upright, and not sing. The screen allowed this person to do both, to sing with the collective, to participate fully in this 1 hour of their week, just like everyone else. I think about that moment with Natalie every time we are invited to sing. And I think about that note every single week that I have not made the time to utilize that screen. Last June, like every June, hundreds of Unitarian Universalist ministers gathered before our annual General Assembly. Networking and workshops, it's the largest platform and way of connecting to colleagues and friends that we have. And each year, because we are ministers and cannot help ourselves, there are numerous worship services. Now, full disclosure, I didn't attend last year, but I could not have avoided the fallout from one of those services if I had tried. Here are the hymns that were chosen. Guide my feet. One more step and standing on the side of love. The sermon was about walking and used the story of Peter in Matthew, walking on water and then becoming afraid and sinking. These are beloved hymns and a beloved story with deep metaphor. The sermon was, in fact, one of my favorites that I have listened to a dozen times or more since, but not one mention of different ways of moving or different abilities. And one of the most egregious parts of this whole thing, the service was planned by a team that we call ARAOMC. Anti-racism, anti-oppression, and multiculturalism, the team of UU ministers whose charge it is to think about who is missing from a service, who is not being spoken to, recognized, whose voice we aren't hearing, whose presence we aren't acknowledging. When folks returned to their homes, something erupted. Years of microaggressions toppled, and there was an outcry, a rallying cry of both hurt and defensiveness. You, I am sure, are feeling the argument before I even tell you what the argument was. A disgust that metaphor was dead, that we take ourselves too seriously, and a shock that if Unitarian Universalists couldn't understand how words matter, how inclusivity takes intention, then we were fooling ourselves with principles and theology that were for naught. The debates went back and forth for some time, and only finally somewhat put to rest when Jason Shelton, minister and author of our hymn, Standing on the Side of Love, announced that he would be changing the words. The words entitled to a beloved hymn, to the banners and the movement that has inspired thousands, the words needed to be changed. Ableism is the practices and dominant attitudes in society that devalue and limit a person with disabilities. It's a set of practices or beliefs that assign inferior value or worth to people who have developmental, emotional, physical, or psychiatric abilities. Now, today I am focusing mostly on the physical, but consider that list just for a moment again. Developmental, emotional, physical, or psychiatric. There are many hidden barriers to our participation, to our connection, the thing that we hold in the highest esteem. Shelton speaks of his decision to change the language in a sermon that helped shape much of what I offer today. Like him, like most UU ministers, I am trained in anti-racism and anti-oppression work that has to do with race and ethnicity, sexual or gender orientation, but I will name right here that this is an area in which I need to seek guides. I moved pretty fluidly through the arguments my colleagues were having, wanting, of course, to honor the bodies that make up the human experience while also mourning my metaphors to stand, to see, to move into the light, resisting the exclusion, resisting the ownership of having excluded those who cannot stand, that blindness means ignorance, that lightness, whiteness, is to be marked as chosen or divine. This is an inherently uncomfortable topic. And not like I originally imagined when sitting down to write this sermon, because we are attached to our words. That's what I thought this whole thing would be about. We're attached to our words, so attached to our words, words that are habits, words that so many of us have found salvation in, because at least for many, they are stripped of sin and Savior. How could they need to be changed? We might remember the first time we heard the UU version of a hymn from our childhood, and we might remember the surprise we had in clumsily singing of a gender-neutral God or nature, of including sisters where once we had only sang of brothers. And we might remember wondering if something we loved or participated in or just didn't think anything of was wrong. We might remember that there is some kind of sadness, some kind of guilt and hurt in thinking about our words. And this isn't, interestingly, because this is the next place that I went to, inherently uncomfortable because we are so attached to our spaces. This space that has been not only a place of homecoming, but of transformation for so many. This space that has done such good work. Chairs that are far enough from the walls for wheelchairs to move through. Chairs rather than pews. And a chairlift that we are trying to make part of our culture. And yet, watch how folks would rather miss fellowship hour or struggle up and down those stairs rather than use that chairlift. And let's not name how this pulpit and chancel say exactly which bodies are allowed to preach. As Shelton says, that dissonance in how what was powerful and transforming for me hurt you. So why then is this so inherently uncomfortable, or why, in addition to those already mentioned and likely felt? I think it's because right now, no matter our body's ability, we are all more able-bodied today than we will be in the years to come. Generally speaking, unless you're gearing up for some intentional physical change, we can do more today than we will be able to. And in this culture, in which we value independence, in which we value doing, it's pretty terrifying to truly empathize, not sympathize, but to place our body into those who can't, or can't like we can, or can't like we value. It is sort of the challenge of every ism for the privileged. And yet, within this particular ism, hidden deep within the conversation, the defensiveness, the work, is a little bit of a nod to mortality, too, isn't there? Of dependence, of loss, of control, loss of being seen, of being remembered, of being significant. And so what's hardest about this one, about ableism, is that it isn't talking about them that we can move ourselves away from, but that it's talking about us. Maybe not right now, but if we are lucky, one day. Jason Shelton tells this story in his sermon of a woman he knows who has polio, and she has since childhood. She uses a scooter or arm braces to assist her in getting around. And when talking about his hymn, Standing on the Side of Love, the woman said, "The issue isn't the word. I get that it's a metaphor. What I don't know is if you know that I am here. And all you have to do is let me know that you see me, that you know that I'm important, and I will get my crutches and I will sing with you on the top of my lungs. All you have to do is let me know that you see me." Isn't that what we each want? And isn't the absence of this the thing that we fear? I share the sermon with you today on a Sunday in which we introduce the monthly theme of risk, and that is intentional. It is a huge risk to receive the truth about our imperfections, to admit where we have faltered, to realize what we haven't ever had to think about, or maybe worse yet, to face why we might wish to avoid it altogether. Our closing hymn today will be answering the call to love, the call of love, which is the new title and words to standing on the side of love. I have put it on the screen. Now, what's so interesting about hearing your laughter in that moment is that I think you will appreciate that it all feels a little clumsy. Learning new words, letting go of words that I love, and maybe a little dangerous too, which is actually what I think I heard in that laughter. We don't have a system in place to make that screen work for us well enough yet. So it feels like a promise I'm making that I want to make before I understand what it will mean. Does that sound familiar for any of those folks in Beloved Conversations? Any of those folks who participated in our racial justice initiative last year? A promise that you want to make before you even understand what it means. And saying that you're going to do it anyway. Because that's risk. And risk is just as much of a spiritual practice as running or praying or anything else that gives you life. It's also the privilege of getting to choose how we will make the world for others. So what if it's a little clumsy? And so what if it's going to take some extra work? If we want to be on the right side, if we want to be part of the weight that bends the arc, we need to answer to the call of love. I leave you with a comment Jason Shelton made on Facebook about this, a few months removed from the initial conversation. He says, "What I love most about this change, which I really do love, and am quite convinced that the new metaphor is more theologically useful and accurate, is what happens after singing the new words in the first chorus. We then sing verse 2. It goes, sometimes we build a barrier to keep love tightly bound. It has yet to fail to make me cry." May it be so, and blessed be.